A local lawmaker shares his COVID experience, and we'll meet the Miami Heat team doctor. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones, back in early July, tweeted out that he had COVID. He has recovered, but he has some harsh criticism about the contact tracing program. Also, Joaquin Oliver would have turned 20 this week. He was one of the victims in Parkland. A day-long Facebook event in his honor tomorrow raises money for gun reform legislation. It'll include Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden and former Heat star Dwayne Wade. And finally,
before they went into the bubble, every one of the players was tested essentially every day.
We'll meet the team doctor for the Miami Heat and Inter Miami. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, Tropical Storm Isaias is heading north toward the Carolinas. Florida was lucky. The storm never grew into a major threat, and it stayed mostly off the coast. The storm transitioned from a Category 1 hurricane pounding Puerto Rico and the Bahamas with a lot of rain before turning back into a tropical storm. Emergency managers said this was an important dry run in what has already been a very busy storm season. Palm Beach County did get hit with a lot of rain and wind, and there were thousands without power. Joining us now is WLRN's Danny Rivero to give us an update. Danny, great to have you back.
Glad to be here.
How hard did Isaias impact Palm Beach County?
Short answer, not very hard. At some point, the county was appearing to be in the crosshairs of tropical storm then Isaias. But towards the last minute, it really kind of let up, and it was downgraded from a hurricane to a tropical storm, and it just kind of barely brushed the county. The Bill Johnson, the emergency manager for Palm Beach County, said in a press conference yesterday on Sunday that about 2,600 customers lost power from some of the outer bands, but most of that was restored within just a couple hours. And beyond that, he said there was no reports of real strong storm surge or major flooding, just a few reports of downed trees and about 20 street lights that went out across the county.
And, of course, they were bracing themselves for possibly a Category 1 storm. What was the deal with their shelters? Had they opened their shelters?
Yes, they did open the shelters. And Bill Johnson said that it was important as kind of a dry run because things are different now with the coronavirus 19 pandemic. And he said that there was about 200 people total that evacuated to shelters. And they did that with social distancing, so that required kind of moving cots, moving things around into certain formations that would allow for more social distancing. And it was a good dry run. He said there was no real issues, but it's kind of, you know, it's good to go through something when you don't need it, just to know how to do it when possibly a next storm comes, and then it'll be an actual emergency situation.
And interesting, as you said, most customers who lost their power did get it back or getting it back because there was a concern that with the pandemic, that getting power back might take a little longer than expected.
That's right. And yesterday on Sunday, the FPL spokesperson, Dave Reuter, gave a press conference as well. And he did address it. He said, you know, it wasn't something that came up as an issue. He was just telling people, you know, obviously COVID-19 is still out there. If you see crews out working in front of your house, out in the community somewhere, you know, be mindful of it, you know, give them room. But it didn't appear that this was the particular issue that came up over the weekend.
And you have done a lot of reporting on the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas. Wondering, have you heard anything about, you know, the impact on the Bahamas? What did they get?
Yeah, I have. I talked yesterday to a bunch of people that I met over the course of some of my reporting in the northern Bahamas, especially in Grand Bahama Island. And they were bracing, you know, there's still parts of that island that do not have usable drinking water because the 30-foot storm surge from Hurricane Dorian has still left parts of the island without drinking water. And they were really, you know, mindful that, you know, another hit before they've even recovered from Hurricane Dorian about 10 months ago could really be devastating, even if it was just a Category 1 or so. There was some flooding, but it was really held to the lower lying areas, is what I've been told in videos that were shared with me showed. And it was, you know, about a foot or so, maybe a little bit more than that in some areas. But, you know, what I heard for the most part was, you know, thank God that it didn't hit us really hard.
Yep. Luckily, Hurricane Dorian weakened and just, again, skated across the coast of Florida, not really hitting us much at all. WLRN's Danny Rivera with the update. Danny, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, South Florida, for the most part, avoided the worst of what Tropical Storm Isaias could have been. But the storm did hit parts of the Bahamas. As Danny Rivero said, some neighborhoods had flood waters that seemed pretty high. Looking at social media, there were some videos people were posting, water up above the knee in some places. We're joined now by Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones from Southern Broward County. We should note Representative Jones is running for re-election, facing six candidates in District 35. Representative Jones, great to have you back.
Thank you for having me, Lewis. Good to hear from you.
I wanted to start with, the tropical storm, because you have Bahamian roots. You were on this program after Hurricane Dorian telling us about, you know, some of the stories that you had heard from your family members. You have family mm-hmm. who are in the Bahamian government. Mm-hmm. Again, Isaias, it didn't turn into anything big. But what have you heard from family and friends? What happened over there?
My family over in the Bahamas, they just said that there was a lot of rain, a tad bit of flooding, but nothing as bad as Hurricane Dorian brought to them.
So beyond the flooding videos that we've seen, really nothing serious to report.
That's correct. Nothing serious to report. And they just said it's something my cousin Chrissy made mention of, it just being like a normal rainy day with a lot of wind. A lot of wind and rain, but nothing as bad as it was last year.
But yeah, I have you here. I have to ask, what's been the rebuilding process been like in places like Grand Bahama and Great Abaco?
So I know in Grand Bahama, they have been on a very steady building process. It's taking them just a tad bit longer. But Abaco is still, they are really still in a cleanup stage, because they don't have a lot of the resources like we have over here in the state. So it's just taking them a little bit longer to be able to do it. But they are rebuilding. And like I said last year, the Bahamian people are resilient people. So they're doing their best with what they have to build their country back up.
What's something that we don't know about what's been going on with the rebuilding? Because it's a story that's kind of fallen by the wayside because of the pandemic. But, because I just wanted to kind of follow up on what you're just saying. Like, I mean, they were devastated. Mm-hmm. Are they close to anything that was normal before the storm?
I guess the one thing that one thing my cousin Nico shared that they are close back to normal on is a lot of families have been able to be reunited, because as early as March or April, there were families that still couldn't find family members. So they are close to reuniting 100% of family members.
And I'm just I'm curious, for the Bahamas in general, you know, just all the Bahamas, how has this pandemic impacted them, especially tourism?
Well, it did impact them a tad bit, especially in the beginning. But towards the end, towards the end of, as far as their numbers are concerned, they started coming around, and their curve started flattening. And when they saw that our numbers were spiking, that's when they put a travel ban for U.S. citizens to come over to the Bahamas, because they, as one of their leaders over Bahamas made mention, that we were being careless with how we were handling coronavirus over here in the States, and they hopped right on it. I think their number of deaths and their number of cases are currently down, but I think they did open the country back up to citizens, but they have to bring their paperwork that they've been checked.
Again, talking with Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones from Southern Broward County, talking with him about Isaias in the Bahamas. Again, not much damage. The storm did fizzle out a bit. I want to shift over because we're starting to talk about the pandemic. And I want to talk about you personally, because you tested positive for COVID-19 back in early July.
I did.
And I remember, you know, your social media account at one point, you had said, I've got COVID-19. I feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on? What happened? How did you find out?
July the 26th, I woke up and I just didn't feel like myself. I was extremely exhausted. You know that feeling that you get when you feel like you're catching the flu or cold. So I figured, well, maybe my body is just tired. So I laid back down. And then the next day I felt the same. And the next day I felt the same. And then Sunday I felt horrible. And I said, I don't know. I haven't been sick in the last 6 or 7 years. And then that Monday, I just couldn't breathe. So I went to the emergency room. The doctor initially said I had an upper respiratory infection. And I'm like, doc, I don't know if that's correct. I've had that before. This seems like something totally different. And then come to find out, my results came back, and it came back I was positive with COVID. And I felt awful. I honestly felt terrible.
Knowing that you had COVID, I mean, and again, the fact that you were feeling as bad as you did, I mean, what is that like for you?
Well, I'll be honest with you. When I found out that I had COVID, my mind instantly went into a very negative place because of how everything has been reported about COVID. So it takes you on a emotional roller coaster when it comes to once you hear about it. But you quickly have to switch your thinking and switch your mindset in. I'm going to get better. But I don't care how much you try to switch your mind to that you're going to get better. There's something that's constantly going through your body that your body is trying to fight something off. Because my temperature kept shooting up to 103, 102, and I could not seem to get my temperature to come back down. But I intentionally said to myself when I first got COVID that I'm going to document this, because for everybody who think that this is fake or this is a hoax or they don't want to wear a mask, I'm going to put this in a real life scenario for you.
By the way, I wanted to clarify, because you got this, it was at the end of June into early July, right?
That's right. I got caught it on June. I found out I started feeling bad. My onset symptoms was on July 26th, and then I found out I had it on July the 2nd.
It was July 2nd. I see. Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the recovery process then like for you? As you said, you wanted to document this, but mm-hmm. how long was that, those feelings for, how long did you feel bad? When did you start to get better?
I felt bad for about 14 days, for 15 days. Day 16, I thought I was feeling okay. I went outside to go for a walk. And as I was walking, my chest got extremely tight. And so I didn't know what was going on. So I started having like a panic attack. So I had to calm myself down. And then I got back home and I took me some Theraflu and I kind of laid back down. And I had to get tested again. When I got tested again, although I thought I would probably be negative, I was still positive. And so then I got another test that following week. Then come to find out, I got a negative test. But even after that negative test, I felt so bad because I have been reading up on like post-COVID symptoms. And the post-COVID symptoms, they feel like you still have COVID. So I went back to go get tested for COVID again. And it came back negative again. So even recovery now has even been extremely difficult because I still get tired. I still cough a lot. Although I'm negative, it's just still been a very interesting recovery process.
Do you have any idea where you might have gotten it or how?
I don't know where I got it from. You know, and I will say, I mean, in one of my, I think it was like on day 4 or 5, when I posted my diary, I said that I was negligent in my actions, because I became, you know, just like everybody else. You know, when the state opened back up, yeah, it was like the floodgates. Everybody wanted to go out, and I started seeing my family, and so I'm hugging and I'm doing all of these things, and not realizing that it still wasn't safe to do it right now.
And I'm going to ask you about your family in a moment here, but since you tested positive, you had an experience with contact tracers.
Yeah.
And you've been very outspoken about how not impressed you are. You called it a joke. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, because after I found out I had COVID, I got a call from the contact tracer the next day, and when she asked me about my diagnosis, she said, "You have COVID." I said, "I do." And she started going through like one or two questions, and I had to ask her. I said, "Let me ask you a question." I said, "By any chance, I said, are you calling from the hospital or the health department?" She said, "Oh no, just to reiterate, I'm calling from the health department." And so she asked me like, "When did I get my symptoms? Was I around anyone?" I'm like, "Yeah." She's like, "Was anyone in the car with you?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm not sure if anybody was in the car with me." And then her follow up question wouldn't have led her to find out, you mean, or to find out whether or not I was around anyone, because she just wasn't asking the right questions. But then her phone hung up, and then I didn't hear back from anyone until after I called them out, the health department out on Twitter. And then I have to be honest, they did start doing much better, not just with myself, but with other people, and so I find out. But I did get a phone call from a contact tracer. It was an anonymous email that came just 2 days ago, who said that they're making the calls, but people are now not willing to divulge who they've been around. And so I think this is an awareness issue now that falls on the department, that they probably need to get the word out to people, to, as they're doing contact tracing or they're making these contacts with people, they want to put it out that, listen, if you can please cooperate with these contact tracers so we can begin to mitigate the spread of COVID-19.
So they're telling you, they said in the message that now you have folks who just don't want to divulge who they've been around if they tested positive.
Listen, they don't want to divulge who they've been around. And so he made it clear that it's difficult for them to do proper contact tracing.
Your parents and your older brother tested positive for COVID-19 after your test came back.
They did.
First of all, how are they doing?
My parents are doing well. And Louis, I'll be honest with you, I'm such a mama's and daddy's boy that I'd much rather me go through this than my parents go through this, because my dad is 74, my mom is 71, although extremely healthy. I just did not want my parents to have to deal with this. My dad had to go to the hospital one time. My mom had to go to the hospital. She was in there for 4 days. My brother had to go to the hospital. And so it was, for the past 2 weeks, it was extremely stressful, because I just didn't want anything to happen to my parents, because I know I gave it to them. Because after my brother passed away 2 years ago, we just have this tradition that we get together every Saturday. And I know I was the one who had given this to them. And I just felt horrible for almost the last 2 weeks. I felt horrible. But they just got their negative test results on Saturday, so I was excited.
Well, that's good. That's very good to hear.
Yeah.
You've asked the governor to issue a statewide mandatory mask order. A lot of people have. But what have you heard from the governor's office?
So it's mixed, right? So there's when it comes to the rent moratoriums and things, the governors have been extremely responsive on, right? But when it comes to things like a mandatory mask order, the governor's office, they haven't budged in this area, which is unfortunate, because scientists and epidemiologists, they have all made it clear that masks slows the spread of COVID-19. And I understand why the governor doesn't want to go this route. I don't understand from the perspective of it not, from the perspective of what everybody else is doing. I understand why he's not, because they're looking at it as a political statement, because people are calling against their civil liberties and all this stuff. So they're not responding because of politics, which is pretty, it's just... it's not a good place, and it's not a good look for him as the governor.
And how would this be enforced? I mean, we've seen in South Florida, there are fines, for people who are walking around without their masks. Do you think that's something we could do statewide?
Well, I mean, I think we would need to look at how we enforce it. I don't think we should be putting people in jail. Let's put that in, to be sure. But should people get fined for it? For the safety of people, absolutely. I mean, we're in the middle of a global health pandemic. And right now, I think the best way that we could begin to slow the spread and to mitigate everything that's happening with the numbers skyrocketing and our hospitalizations being up is we have to go to the extreme right now, because it's for the betterment of every last one of us.
Have you spoken with any Republicans in the state house? I mean, is there any support on this?
I'll be honest with you. They might not say it publicly. I can tell you that privately, Republicans who I've spoken to, they are in favor of it. There's one of my colleagues who is he's the only one who's traveling the state of Florida who's speaking against masks and suing cities who have asked for mandatory mask orders. And so he's in an island all by himself. But there are two of my Republican colleagues who both have been infected with COVID. And if you go look at their Twitters, they too are even saying, take this seriously, wear your mask, because it's the right thing to do. It's for the betterment of everyone.
With everything that you've been through, I'm wondering how that shaped your thinking about the fact that school's about to start. And we're also in an election year, and we got two elections coming up, one this month and then, of course, the November one. What's going through your mind?
Well, I'm literally at the polling location now, the campaign, and right as we speak. So in the midst of COVID, it's difficult, because even the people who are coming to vote, they don't want to grab your material. I don't want you to grab material. I hope you came already knowing who you're going to vote for. But people are really, really scared. You can tell. So that's the one thing that's going through my mind is, yeah, you know, how will voting look with early voting and voting starting happening on the 18th, schools opening up. I support Superintendent Runcie and Superintendent Carvalho, who says that we're not opening up schools right now. That's the best decision to make. Our teachers are not disposable, and our children are not lab rats. Well, we should be testing to see whether or not they are getting infected or not. I used to be a teacher. Classroom is a petri dish of bacteria and germs. And with the numbers looking like they're looking right now, it is just not the way we should be going as a state and enforcing schools to open back up. It's a bad idea.
I want to thank our guest, Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones from Southern Broward County. Again, he is running for re-election, facing six candidates in the District 35 race. Early voting started today in Monroe County, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties as well. Representative Jones, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Louis. Thank you.
All right. Well, still to come, why are Joe Biden and Dwayne Wade joining together for a South Florida virtual event? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Tomorrow would mark the 20th birthday for Joaquin Guac Oliver. He was one of the 17 students and faculty killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas in February of 2018. In honor of their son and his activism, his parents, Manuel and Patricia Oliver, are hosting a 20-hour live stream called Guacathon. It's through the Facebook page of their nonprofit, Change the Ref, which supports youth movements for gun control reform. The event will feature appearances from Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, former NBA superstar Dwayne Wade, and many more. The Olivers have also been focused on the Black Lives Matter movement, organizing a march in Parkland several weeks ago. Patricia Oliver joins us now to talk about this. Patricia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
What was the inspiration to have, it's a 20-hour event, it's practically all day.
Well, it's Joaquin's birthday. It's Joaquin's 20th birthday. That is the inspiration that we have.
Are you going to be on camera for the full 20 hours?
Yeah, we will. We will be all day long. We're going to start at 6 o'clock in the morning. We're going to end it at 2 in the morning.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. How did you connect with people like Joe Biden and Dwayne Wade? You have Stacey Abrams, Gabby Giffords. You have Pearl Jam. You have all these big names.
Well, you know that sadly, since we are in this path, we being on the road, and we were meeting a lot of different people. So the way that God put us on this is let us meet those kind of personalities, celebrities, politicians. So we decided that, you know, what should we do for Joaquin's birthday? And it's his 20th. And he was so happy every time he was getting close to a birthday. So we have to do something on Joaquin's style. So what can we do if we are from home? So we were thinking, and we got it that finally it's going to be something online. Okay, fine. So then we start reaching friends, we start reaching the, you know, about politicians. We met John Biden once, we've been with Nancy Pelosi like 3-4 times in different events, actually, from us. So we've been having the opportunity with Wei, you know, that everything that happened with Wei, he was so amazing and special with Joaquin since this happened. Joaquin was a huge fan of him, and it was a connection there. His mom and his sister came home to meet me, and, you know, we developed this connection that we got a chance to get back to them. And, well, they respond. And they support the cause and so many others. And maybe they don't have huge names on the market, but still are doing something to make a difference.
Yeah.
So you will meet a lot of new people that deserve to be heard also.
And by the way, you said because you're on the road. What does that mean?
Well, you know that when happened this to Joaquin, we decided to go and do something to honor, because we couldn't understand that we couldn't leave this situation in vain. So we decided to go out and speak out. Happens to be that my husband is an artist. We started with the Walls of Demand, and the way we were communicating to people was really interesting for some others, organizations or corporations. And that's when we started all regarding the campaigns that we have. That actually we're going to share a few of them tomorrow. So that's mainly why I'm calling that we are on the road.
Oh, I see. And you're raising money, and it's for the nonprofit Change the Ref. That's your organization. How is the money going to be used? How do you foresee that?
Well, we always proceed through events, activations that encourage kids and youth, and even today, adults, I can tell, that they are willing to help and they weren't able to have a voice or to identify with something that it really motivated them to be going out and speak. Because this is a situation that we have today that we cannot be blaming others or pointing on others that they aren't doing their thing. We are part of that. We have our right to vote. We have our right to go out and claim what is right, and that's why we pay taxes, and that's why we live in the country that has laws that has to protect us. So that's why we need that platform to be able to move here and there and to encourage the other kids that they can maybe not able to do something or to put activities that they can let their communities know the message that we want to spread and that we have to be together in this work.
Again, I'm talking with Patricia Oliver. Her son, Joaquin Oliver, known as Guac, was one of the victims in the Parkland shooting. Tomorrow, their nonprofit organization, Change the Ref, is hosting a 20-hour live stream in honor of their son's, what would be his 20th birthday. And again, people like Joe Biden, Dwayne Wade, Pearl Jam will be making appearances. And you can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Patricia, what have been the intersections with the Black Lives Matter movement and your organization on gun control?
Well, Black Lives Matter is a situation that we've been having here, well, since I'm here since 17 years ago already, but this is something that is happening here in the country for centuries. So it's really directly connected to gun violence. They are the ones that suffer most. They are the ones, if they are in a group together, in a gathering, if they look with a hoodie on, they will be looking at them first. And because of that, we decided to be there for them. So we are inclusive. We include everybody. You know, I don't know if you are aware that we have a play that is called Wack, My Son, My Hero.
Yes.
And we show in part of the play the different flags that represent different groups, like LGBTQ. They are always get confused with the
LGBTQ. Yeah.
Yes, there's so many letters. So we identify with them. Actually, we're going to be having a group of them tomorrow with their show that is amazing. So we identify with the Black Lives Matter because Joaquin was always concerned about that. That the injustice,
yeah,
the discriminations, the small, you know, we are a small groups. So immigrants, we belong to a small groups that we need to be here and we need to be together because we're all suffering the same thing.
I wondered if you've talked to educators, if you've talked to the school district about all the changes they've made. Do you feel that they've done enough to make not just Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, but schools safer?
Well, that is something that, you know, is hard to answer because we are more national. We don't care about just our school because our school is very local. And really, we are in a community that is really safety, accepting the tragedy that we lived. But the fact is that there's so many communities that they're suffering that every single day. Every single one. And they are not covering because the media has sometimes kind of, is kind of scared that they can be in danger if they go to those communities and cover those news. So that's why we are there for them also, because this is something that we also knew because we were on the road, as I said before, we met those people that belong to those communities that they can have a voice because they don't cover their issues.
Again, the group, the nonprofit group, is called Change the Ref. They're going to be hosting a 20-hour live stream featuring appearances again from Joe Biden and Dwayne Wade and Pearl Jam and more. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Patricia Oliver, again, I'm so sorry for your loss, but I know tomorrow would be a special day, and I'm wishing you the best tomorrow.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, still to come, we're going to meet the team doctor for the Miami Heat. He's been with them for 3 decades. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Miami Heat kicked off their return to basketball with a big win on Saturday against the Denver Nuggets. Action in the NBA bubble in Orlando began last week. For the past 33 years, Dr. Harlan Selznick has been the Heat's team doctor, all the way back since the franchise started back in the late 80s. Selznick was not included in the limited roster that teams are allowed as part of the bubble, but he may head back to Orlando for the playoffs. He's also the doctor for the Inter Miami, and he was there for the return to soccer for MLS. We spoke with Dr. Selznick about both teams' COVID preparations and his long career with the Heat. So you're working with a Major League Soccer team, Inter Miami, and they're playing in a tournament in Orlando, and it's an effort to get sports back during the pandemic. But I'm wondering, as a doctor, how do you feel about sports trying to continue as a virus is spreading the way it is?
I mean, everyone has concerns. And so there's really two areas of concern in terms of as a physician. The first area, of course, is minimizing the risk of COVID spreading to other teammates and ultimately to their families or coaches, staff members. And that's one major risk that we are concerned about. And the second risk is, remember, guys really didn't train for 3 to 4 months. And now you're asking them to go back and try and play with less training than they're used to having. And the injury risk is probably more significant. If you think generally, like, people come into a training camp in shape and then they go through training camp, that's a whole lot different than 3 or 4 months being stuck in your apartment minimal amount of running or things outside and then trying to play right away.
So there's that extra layer of it, is the fact that they have not been on their schedule, and so the chances of them getting hurt go up a lot.
Well, no one knows how much, but it's certainly a concern. In any of the sports that are going back, the trainers and the strength and conditioning coaches and whatever work on stretching, flexibility. When you're dealing with soccer, there's a lot of overuse injuries in terms of hamstring injuries and things like that, that proper conditioning can decrease that risk. Heat exhaustion is an issue for not so much the teams in Miami and Orlando, but some of the northern teams that came down to the Orlando bubble. And the NBA also has those same concerns about not having a usual training camp, not coming into training camp in shape, and then subsequently trying to get ready in 2-3 weeks to play at a very competitive level.
So the MLS and the NBA are in Orlando. They're playing in this bubble, all right? I keep hearing this term about, this bubble, and it's basically how the teams isolate in order to keep the virus out. But how does it work? How would you describe this bubble?
They're separate bubbles between the NBA and Major League Soccer. I'm a little bit more familiar with how the NBA bubble was set up, so I'll talk a little bit about that. David Weiss, who's an attorney for the NBA and deals with the team physicians, has done an unbelievable job in terms of trying to make it as safe as possible. They've consulted with infectious disease experts from a number of institutions in the U.S., as well as even with the Dr. Fauci himself. So they've worked that way. And what they did is, before training camp even began, the training facility, I'll talk about Miami, was limited to 4 players at a time, 1 player working out themselves in one corner of the gym, having no interaction with anybody else, just kind of working on shooting and things. That went on for a couple weeks. Before they went into the bubble, every one of the players was tested essentially every day for COVID to make certain that nobody was going to be COVID positive when they arrived in Orlando. And if someone did test as COVID positive, they would be kept out of the bubble until they subsequently would have 2 negative tests, be asymptomatic for a number of days, and also have cardiology screening, because COVID has been shown to have some cardiac effects in some patients, and the players have to go through evaluation by a cardiologist, get an EKG, and an echocardiogram before they would be allowed back into the bubble. When they get to Orlando, the players would then be tested again on 2 separate tests, 24 hours apart, be quarantined until those tests were also negative, and then they would be allowed into a situation where whenever they're interacting with anyone else, they would have to wear masks, maintain social distancing, hand washing, and then they were allowed to begin practicing with those parameters, as well as limiting exposure to players on other teams.
As the team doctor, you're used to spending a lot of time with the players, but how does it work, with Inter Miami and with the Miami Heat? How much time are you going to just spend in Orlando with the teams?
Well, Inter Miami, I actually went up for the first game, but to do that, I was tested 72 hours in advance, 24 hours in advance here in Miami, drove straight up to Orlando, was tested there, and quarantined till the test came back negative, and then was allowed to cover the game as the venue medical director. And then I came back. As far as the NBA goes, they have a much longer quarantine period and different rules. And what the league has done is they've found NBA doctors that had the ability to take some time off, some former NBA doctors, some regional doctors, and anyone that is willing to cover all the teams and commit to at least a month at a time is allowed in the bubble as a physician. So I'm not going to be able to have a whole lot of interaction being at the games, which is something we're not used to, you know, particularly when it comes to the playoffs. You know, it tends to be important to have your own team physician there to make sure that it's safe for your player to play, someone's not pulled out that could play, that someone that has a laceration doesn't take too long to have it sutured or whatever. So that can affect the outcome of games. So there are concerns with that. The hope is that maybe when we make it to the second round of the playoffs, things will open up a little bit and I'll be able to go up there. But right now, I think the Oklahoma City doctor has been assigned to help cover our team.
I'm speaking with Dr. Harlan Selznick, team doctor for the Miami Heat and Inter Miami. Dr. Selznick was in Orlando for the restart of the MLS season. You can find more of our coverage of the return of professional sports in the bubble in Orlando by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. You've also worked with high schools in your career, and you know, this is obviously the big topic right now is, you know, will schools reopen? But we haven't heard much of anything about, you know, will there be high school sports? And I'm wondering, you know, what do you think is the future for high school sports? Do you think there's going to be sports this year? Should there be?
Well, I think it really depends on the sport. Obviously, if schools don't reopen, I don't see how they can have sports activities. Some sports like football, where there's really intimate close contact, even if they wore masks and face shields, I'm not sure that that's going to be safe or effective. I'm not an infectious disease expert, but you know, I think the school systems right now, our major concerns are really finding a safe way to have school, and I think sports is on the back burner for right now. I think until we get a vaccine and things really start coming back to normal, I don't think you're going to see normal sports in the schools, but that's just my opinion. And
let me switch things up. I want to ask you about, I read some of your Jock Doc articles in the Miami Herald, and I found one from a couple of years ago. A student asked you, what does it take to get into sports medicine? And I guess, you know, briefly, I mean, how do you describe what it takes to specialize in sports medicine?
Yeah, well, there's two avenues, really, where someone can get into sports medicine. Obviously, you have to go through medical school. And when you're in medical school, you're kind of exposed to numerous options, you know, cardiology, dermatology, obstetrics, orthopedics, whatever. And if you have a real interest in sports medicine, you're usually looking at going one of two pathways, either doing a residency in orthopedic surgery, like I did, or doing a residency in primary care, family practice medicine. And there, then in this day and age, there's fellowships that once you finish your residency, it's usually an additional year of sports medicine training. In terms of orthopedic surgery, it's game exposures, team exposures, everything from recreational to professional.
Why did you get into it?
Well, when I started out, sports medicine really didn't exist. I had actually read an article in the New York Times about one of the first sports medicine doctors in this new field that was being created. I always loved sports. I liked orthopedic surgery, and it just seemed like a great combination for me. When I went to medical school, I didn't know what I'd do. My father was an obstetrician. I decided after going through medical school, that was not what I wanted to do. And sports medicine just was an exciting new avenue, and I've been lucky to be able to do it.
Did you grow up watching sports, or did you play?
Well, you know, the answer is I grew up watching sports. I played a number of sports, tennis and basketball and things in high school. But, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity for short, slow Jewish point guards. And so I felt that I had a better shot in longevity of doing it as a doctor.
Thank you for that. You know, when talking about basketball, I mean, you've been with the Miami Heat since the beginning of the team. How did you end up with them?
I've been very fortunate. The average team physician's in the league about 4 years. And as I said, this is my 32nd year. When I was in medical school, I had the opportunity to be the assistant team physician for the Chicago Bulls when I was at Northwestern for several years. And also, the NBA used to have, and still does, has a combine where college players will play for a number of days before the team scouts. And I met a number of people involved. When I came to Miami, there really weren't many sports doctors, and I think every orthopedic surgeon in town applied. And I interviewed, and even though I was young, they were nice enough to give me an opportunity to show that I could do the job, and so far I'm still doing it.
So the team started in 1988. What's your fondest memory of that first season?
The first season, obviously the championship years were a lot of fun. But the first season was really probably the most fun short of those championship years. Everything was new. We had an opportunity to set up the sports medicine and the training and everything that we considered state-of-the-art at the time. All the players were new or excited to be there. Ron Rothstein was the coach, who was very colorful in his youth. And it was just an incredible amount of fun. So I would say just that whole first season, I can't think of one specific memory, was just an incredible amount of fun.
You talk about being with the championship teams, and obviously, you know, people are going to ask about when you were there with the Big Three, and I wonder what it was like, you know, being the team doctor for a team that had, you know, these three big superstars, but especially LeBron James. What was it like being the team doctor? Did you feel a lot of pressure treating LeBron James?
Not really. LeBron was actually one of the easiest players to work with that I've ever had. He was great. I mean, he was so involved in his conditioning. He had his own personal trainer. He ate right. He would take 2 or 3 hours extra of treatment a day to maintain his flexibility, his conditioning, his muscles, and he would do whatever was recommended to get better when he was banged up, and he was incredibly durable. So LeBron was phenomenal to work with. I wish every player was like him.
That was Dr. Harlan Selznick, team doctor for the Miami Heat and Inter Miami. We spoke with him several weeks ago before the restart of the NBA season. And you can read more about the return to professional sports in Orlando by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. And let us know, have you been watching any of the sports, any of the action? What do you think of the virtual fans on the sidelines? Kind of kooky, right? A little strange. Anyway, that's our program for this Monday, August 3rd. Sundial senior producers Chris Remington, Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Liv Steinhardt is our intern. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Our theme music, by the way, is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. Find them online, gobalo.com. And don't forget, if you missed the program or any parts of it, you can listen to it again tonight at 8, or you could just download the podcast. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, we have an hour panel-long conversation with teachers ahead of the start of the school year. Things are going to be a lot different with virtual schooling planned across South Florida. Plus, the school year has been delayed across multiple school districts. So parents, students, teachers, we want to hear from you. What concerns do you have for the upcoming school year? What changes would you need to see to feel comfortable having your children back in the classroom? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or you can email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Thanks again for listening. Really do appreciate it. As always, remember, find us at wlrn.org. Listen to any of our programs anytime. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.